Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 36, How We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love Harry Potter, the first of several mini episodes with bonus content. Today, we will be talking with our show's producer and Harry Potter scholar, Lori Beckoff, about how to hold on to Harry Potter. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds, too. My co-host today is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of several Harry Potter essays. Thanks, Emily, for embarking with me on this little coronavirus-inspired adventure.
Aye, Captain. I love this whole idea. So I'm here. I'm ready. I'm home. I'm quarantined. I'm ready to talk Potter.
Great. Yeah, this is how I feel too. We have lots of kind of cool ideas for things that we might give you in like little bite-sized pieces here. So joining us today is Lori Beckoff, our producer, who suggested this idea to provide some additional podcasts for our listeners, since so many of us have had our daily lives disrupted. And we are looking for something to bring us a little bit of light. So tell me, Lori and Emily, are you both turning more to Harry Potter in this time we're living through?
I feel that that is a difficult question to answer because I'm already so deep into it all of the time that I don't really know how much deeper I could possibly go. I suppose I am spending more time doing things for MuggleNet and thinking about the podcast, and I'm home more, so I find the movies on TV more and watch them. But in terms of how much my brain is on it, it's pretty much always on my brain. So I just get to acknowledge that more often right now.
Awesome. What about you, Emily?
Well, I have to admit that I maybe have not sunk deeper into Potter, but I have probably sunk deeper into Star Wars, which is my other great love. Yes. But now there's one exception to that. I would say I got really into the show Stranger Things, which I have very much enjoyed. I'd never watched it. I just caught up with all the seasons. And I saw in Stranger Things a lot of connections to Harry Potter that really triggered my imagination.
I know.
Could be an episode with other Stranger Things, because I did see some aspects of that show that really spoke to a Harry Potter influenced world. So.
Oh, neat. Very yeah. good. Well, I have definitely been thinking of it as my little refuge, my little oasis, you know, amid all of the other things that are going on. Lori, you recently wrote a wonderful piece for MuggleNet that we are centering this episode on, that you titled Holding On to Harry Potter, Modern Myth, Common Tongue. So what inspired you to write that piece, Lori?
So as the universe of Harry Potter, the Wizarding World universe, has expanded beyond the books into many different forms, I've been seeing a lot of mixed reactions from fandom. That's about Cursed Child, about Fantastic Beasts, about the brand and franchise and how it has grown, about J.K. Rowling and what she has had to say about the story afterward, whether on Twitter or on Pottermore or the Wizarding World website, and what she's had to say about other topics as well. And I've noticed on one side people saying, stop criticizing it if you consider yourself a fan. If you're a fan, if you're truly a Harry Potter fan, then you should say, thank you for every bit of Harry Potter you get and not have anything negative to say. And on the other hand, people saying, well, it's time to give it up, clearly. If you don't like this thing and that thing and the quality isn't the same and the books aren't as progressive as we thought when we reread them again, or J.K. Rowling's not as progressive as we thought, and the story is not the same anymore, it's time to move on. And I am solidly in the middle there of I am one of those fans, and I think most fans really are,
yeah,
the type of fans who still love Harry Potter. It means so much to them. They could not abandon it if they wanted to, but they don't necessarily love every single thing about it. And that's not just from newer pieces about it. That's not just saying, oh, I love the books, but I don't like Fantastic Beasts, or I don't like Cursed Child. But saying, oh, you know, I never really loved this aspect of the books, or I always thought this aspect could have been expanded on or been more progressive, because we hail these books as being, you know, meaningful for activism, but that it could have gone farther. They could have been more diverse. They could have been more this. And I think most fans feel this conflict of course, I love Harry Potter. I could not stop loving Harry Potter. But at the same time, there are things I might have done differently or things that I don't love about it. And I think that critical relationship is a good thing to have.
I tend to agree with that. What do you think, Emily? Are you kind of in the middle too?
Oh, I'm definitely in the middle. On one hand, I see where a lot of the criticism is coming from. I you know, because I see the Christianity of the books as kind of central, and I do understand, even though I am myself also a Christian, I see where that can be considered a more conservative worldview. Although I think it's more complicated than that, but I see that. And so some of this for me is like, ooh, wow, you know, these values within the books are kind of bubbling to a head, not even in the books themselves. I don't think that they need to confront people in the books themselves, but in some of the other things that have happened, you know, things that Rowling has said or not said, or, you know, so, but I was just thinking when Laurie was talking about, you know, I was thinking about all the literature that I love that I don't agree with all of. I mean, I grew up reading, you know, classic, like Victorian literature, like a lot of, you know, Jane Austen and the Brontes and Dickens and stuff like that. And there's, you know, you run across things in these books that are like patently offensive,
right?
You know, to a modern sensibility, to our modern worldview. Like a few years ago, I tore through a lot of H.P. Lovecraft.
This
horror writer, or, you know, you could say there's some similar things about Edgar Allan Poe. And H.P. Lovecraft was a scary individual. I mean, he was downright scary. I mean, this is, I think, part of what makes his stories, gives them this real, you know, very viable horror, you know, to them, because he himself had some very aberrant views about humanity, you know, rooted in racism, really, and anti-Semitism. And yet, I actually, you know, I was like, do I have to feel bad about turning to his stories in October when I just want to get the chills, you know, and in a really intelligent way? You know, do I have to feel bad about that? Well, I don't know that or does it make his literature less brilliant? You know, the fact that he had some of these views, you know, yes, it's a tempering device. You know, it's like, it's something that I use to kind of like, I say, well, you know, there are other things too that I also want to read. This isn't the end all be all. But this is a perspective that even with this, you know, his stories are still worth considering and worth thinking about in many ways, especially with that critical eye that says, what elements of the story may be tinged by his views of humanity? You know, where do we see that instead of just dismissing it outright, using it as a critical lens?
Emily, you are reminding me that we actually had some discussions about this when we were talking about Tolkien and Harry Potter.
Because, oh, yes,
Tolkien also has, I mean, such imperialistic views, and like the whole thing with the orcs. There's all kinds of, you know, critiques that we could put onto him. And we were sort of talking about why aren't people, you know, saying, you know, no more Hobbit for me, you know, when we're way beyond a lot of what Tolkien thought now. But we are holding J.K. Rowling to, you know, I would say a pretty high standard on those kinds of issues. And I think it has to do somewhat with, you know, when Harry at, I think it's the beginning of book five, he gets the disillusionment charm put on him. I think that's so interesting. Mad-Eye Moody does it, right? And it feels like a chill going down him. And that is about him coming into a more adult, critical perspective of the world around him. And I mean, it's this magical spell, right, that makes him invisible, I guess. But it also is, I think, a metaphor for what's going to happen to him in the book. And I think we hold J.K. Rowling more responsible because we are, you know, gradually seeing that she's a person who has political beliefs that we don't all agree with, and that, in fact, we find noxious in some ways,
mm-hmm.
and that we're experiencing that chill of the disillusionment charm in a way that with Tolkien, you know, who's already gone and we knew he was from a long time ago, we maybe don't have that same response to.
Right, yeah, and I do think where he's located in history gives him a little bit of an out. Yeah, that's true. I remember when I first got into Tolkien, and I was all amped up on the books, and I was talking to a coworker of mine about it, and she was very dismissive of Tolkien. She was just like, basically like, you're wasting your time. You shouldn't be reading that, you know, because he didn't have a very favorable opinion of women or of people of color or mm-hmm. what. And I was like, it really kind of, but in the end, I think back on it and it makes me sad for her because there's so much to enjoy there that can't really be touched by those issues. I think we do tend to miss out, but I love your metaphor of the disillusionment charm, Katie, because we do in kind of becoming disillusioned a little bit, being able to take a step back from that person we so admired and see them as a person, we do kind of, in a sense, become a little bit less visible ourselves. Like we can take a look at the, we can almost creep on the literature that we love a little bit without imposing our own. We can take a step back even from our own values and try to see it a little bit more objectively. I don't know. It's kind of, I'm thinking about that thing that you go through as a young adult. If you're lucky enough to have your parents into your young adulthood, where you start to just see them as people as well. Mm-hmm. But you get a truer perspective on these very people who raised you. You get a truer perspective on who they really are and even where you come from because of who it is that raised you.
So, Laurie, I think that your piece really touches on that concept of the death of the author idea. And I wondered if you were, you know, informed by that a little bit, the idea. And this is sort of what we're talking about. How much should we be paying attention to the author and who the author is as we enjoy or don't enjoy the literature they produce?
I think it is important to consider, partially because maybe it'll open our eyes to certain analyses we hadn't thought of. But when it comes to the overall meaning of the literature, I do think that a literature, and especially Harry Potter, can stand on its own and does take on its own meaning beyond whatever the author intended or whatever their personality or views are, or what they might say about it afterward. Because in addition to anything political, one of the things that has annoyed people is when J.K. Rowling takes to Twitter and says, oh, I always imagined this character like this, or this thing happened, or she goes on Pottermore and gives us more backstory. And maybe sometimes we like that backstory and say, that's really cool. And she says that she always had that in mind, but didn't get a chance to write it in. And other times people say, you know, I didn't need that much detail. I don't really want that much detail. I like to let the universe exist as it does in my head, and I can fill in the nooks and crannies.
Yeah, don't tell me that Ron and Hermione shouldn't have gotten together and Hermione and Harry should have gotten together instead.
Oh, don't.
I do not need to know that. Please keep that to yourself.
And also, I think that's one of those things that, number one, I think that interview was taken out of context, and I think it was her having a fluid conversation about her own doubts about her own work, as I think any writer does. And I think in the full interview, she kind of comes to it at the end of like, you know what, they'll be all right. So I do think that interview was overblown a bit. But also,
I'm glad to hear that, Laurie. I appreciate that corrective.
I'm not giving up on Ron and Hermione.
Me either.
And part of it is that once, now that that is on the page, whatever she says after, I don't think can really change. Even if we are people who say, I believe that what the author says is canon, I think that the books have so gotten into our systems that no matter what she were to say now, I'm like, I know these characters, though. I know this story so well that whatever you say about that, that's not going to change my experience of reading it and what I know about Ron and Hermione and their relationship and what I believe about that relationship. And that's where I think Death of the Author intersects with the idea of myth making or mythopoeia, and the idea that, especially with fantasy, especially when there is world building, that the universe is going to inevitably grow beyond what the author wrote down. And I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I
I
think.
love your Star Trek reference. I do enjoy Star Trek as well. And you referenced the story of Darmok, which is where you've got a planet full of people who they can't communicate with because the universal translator just doesn't work on them because they communicate in stories. And the famous one is Darmok and Jalahd at Tanagra. Shaka, when the walls fell. So they sort of talk through stories and through characters. And one of your points is that people basically do that with Harry Potter now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one reason I think we can't decide collectively that we don't like it anymore. Even if we decide we don't like it, it's so in our shared subconscious, in the collective psyche, that we know what these references mean. Even if we could deep down say, well, if we really look at it, this is an analogy for that, or it really has a deeper meaning, or that's actually not what it means, or there are lots of things to debate. The ideas are still present, and we all kind of know what we mean when we discuss some of these shared ideas. When we talk about Hogwarts houses, and you could debate, someone could say, I'm a Slytherin, and you could say, well, all Slytherins aren't evil, let me explain. Or, oh, I'm a Hufflepuff, oh, well, Hufflepuffs aren't useless, there's so much more to it, don't think that. But we still kind of know what everyone means. We know, okay, Slytherin, you mean you're ambitious. Hufflepuff, you're fair and hardworking. It has meaning. And that meaning is going to exist whether or not we decide we dislike something about the author, or dislike a new installment, or dislike one thing or another. It's there now, and it's almost an honor, I think, to an author to be, quote, killed by your work, in that the work
Oh,
is
yeah.
so much bigger than you now
Yeah.
that you can't necessarily control every aspect of it. And I don't think that has to mean, we're throwing out the author, we don't care about her anymore. But thank you, author, for giving us this treasure that we can now have all these personal experiences with and use to think about the world around us and about each other and to jump off of and think about other topics more deeply, even if that's with some criticism toward the series. It has grown in a way that I think is really beautiful.
You know, if somebody says something like, "Don't let the muggles get you down," like you get that. You know what that means. And the way that people talk about Voldemort, or the way that, you know, people are harnessing particular stories, I think especially in this moment where we're all experiencing something really new and weird, and you know, that people are making all kinds of parallels to the Harry Potter series because it's helping us to work through it through that concept of the story, and the, you know, the sort of fundamental structure that she built for us that then we take on, you know, and as you say, it has a life of its own.
I'm thinking about Star Wars because I think about Star Wars a lot. But I mean, you know, Star Wars is a lot further down the road of the having worked its way as the kind of collective shared text, you know, collective myths that it is today. It's deeply, deeply embedded in culture, and yet we're living in a post George Lucas era of Star Wars. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people have poked fun at George Lucas because he's been kind of, you know, he's been marginalized by Disney. His ideas, I think, were kind of judged a little outdated, and you know, I mean, rightly so probably. And they've kind of moved past George Lucas, and some people have kind of poked fun at him as somebody, you know, he got on with Charlie Rose and talked about how he didn't like the first sequel movie, and people like panned in, you know, panned his weighing in on that and everything. But really, we should be, it should be, it's all to his credit that this franchise has grown beyond him, you know, and is now unfolding at the hands of people who are deeply influenced by him, but who have their own ideas and who have taken it into a new generation and multiple new generations. And so I think, yeah, I agree. I mean, she's created something that's far bigger than herself. and her attempts to continue to lord over it are always going to be kind of feeble because it just got bigger than her. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, so. What I really find fascinating is also the ways that people respond to J.K. Rowling with her own work in a critical fashion, which I think we just saw at the end of last year with that very controversial tweet that she had about, I guess I would say not just gender, but sex and transsexuality as well, and transgender. And people came back with, here is what I learned from you through the world of Harry Potter. And that became a source of criticism and even a source of back and forth between people who were on different, you know, different sides of that issue. And to me, that's the power of the world that she created for us.
Absolutely. As I brought up in the article I wrote, we have that the world isn't split into good people and Death Eaters. We have finding out that Dumbledore wasn't always a great guy and wasn't a great guy in everything he did. As you mentioned with the disillusionment charm, which I also never thought of, and it's a great parallel, it's not all going to be so black and white. And we are allowed, and I think it is mature of us as readers, to look at both sides, to be able to say, you know what, I don't like this part. I don't like what you have to say about this, or I don't like this aspect of the books. I don't think this part is good. But I think this other part is great, and I think that's still worth holding on to and using. And I've been thinking about this phrase in my mind with disillusionment, that I think what it is for me is that we can become, when it comes to Harry Potter, we can become disillusioned, but never fully disenchanted. In my mind, then, disillusionment doesn't sound like such a bad word, and I'm distinguishing it from disenchantment, is that I absolutely think the illusion that everything here is perfect and we love every single part and there's nothing could ever possibly be wrong with something we love is shattered. That myth is shattered. But the magic isn't lost. I can acknowledge all of those things, and I can be rereading the books and think about something that J.K. Rowling said later, or think about something that I didn't like in Cursed Child or Fantastic Beasts, or think about even something on the page that I go, oh, that could have been done a little better. That could have had more of this or more of that. But I don't feel like putting the book down, and I don't feel like saying, ugh, I don't think I like it anymore. I'm still sucked into that world every time. I still feel the enchantment. And if anything, I feel that I have grown as a person and a reader by being able to look at it and say, this could be done differently. This could be handled another way. But there's still something so rich. And I think that's also a sign of a lot of great myths, that they change over time, and the way people receive them and retell them changes. And I'm not necessarily saying that I want an entire Harry Potter extended universe, but I think the fact that people discuss these things and fill in these gaps, whether through their own writing or just through talking about it or thinking about it, is good for us as a collective readership.
That is awesome, Laurie. What a good, I think, note to end on. The idea that we may be disillusioned, but never disenchanted. I love that.
I love it. I love it. Keep the magic alive.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Laurie, for helping us kick off this special bonus episode series that we're doing. And also, of course, thank you for everything that you do for us as a producer. This was
so
a great idea.
So happy to be here in multiple ways.
Yeah. We are going to continue this series of bonus episodes with some bite-sized podcasts about intriguing side characters, ways the series feels especially relevant right now, predictions for the forthcoming Cormoran Strike novel, maybe I should say fifth coming, this is the fifth one, food, books, and pets of the Potterverse, and maybe we'll even pull out one of Beetle the Bard's stories for a closer look. These are some of the ideas that we have, but if you listeners have some other ideas, please send them our way. We're just looking for, you know, little short snippets. Thanks, Emily, for being my co-host today.
My pleasure.
And I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thanks for all that you do, Emma. We could not do this without you. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. And I have to say, if you are looking for some good Harry Potter escape, the MuggleNet has been putting out lots of really cool content, great stories. The memes, I always love those things too. So you want to check out MuggleNet. Listeners, we are glad you joined us today, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us, and especially if you have an idea for one of these little shorter episodes. We'd love to hear it. You can share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. I'm going to mix up our closing quote just a bit, given the unusual crisis we're collectively experiencing due to COVID-19. So now I leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the light." Please join us next time when we'll be turning on the light with the help of a little Harry Potter magic.